Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser continue at 2, side 2.
Susie and I shipped in stuffy saloon on the terrace about 70 snoring merchants and dowagers with breath, but once I didn't mind the lack of privacy, I needed the rest. Only that Kansas City nowadays covers the section in those days the landing and port independence was separated by wood and meadow. I wonder if Daisy contains more people than were crowded along 10 miles from Independence to the river when I first was in 49. But thousands of them in tents and lean-tos and houses and log shacks and under the trees and in the few taverns and lodging place. There in the stables and sheds and shops and storehouses, a great swarming hive of humanity of every kind you can imagine. Well, I remember the Singapore River in the early days, and it was nothing to West Independence. The whole street was jammed with waggons, carts and carriages, churning the spaces between the buildings, sea of mud after the descent, and through it went the mules, oxen and horses, with the steam rising from a stench of hides of tongue and smoke, filling the air, but in that nothing to the noise. Every other building seemed to be a forge, or a stable, or a house, a clang with hundreds of hammers, a rasped sword, and a crack of axe, and a creak of wheels, and thump and scrape boxes and bales being loaded. Teeters snapped their whistles. Form bellowed, children shrilled, the voices of thousands of men and women blended it all, beat eager zed in that echo among the buildings and floated off, to lost in the surrounding forest. I dare say nothing what it must look like a year or two later, when the gold fever was at height, and half Europe came poor America in search of fortune. When that spring every human specimen in North America seemed to have assembled at Ken's Landing, the great trek west, laborers white and black and olive, bronzed hunters and clerks, over emigrants and raffish venturers, harassed women with apron bus prodigal set out before the storefronts, and slapping the children who bowled round their skirts, red-faced traders in stovepipe hats, and thumbs hooked in sea wickets, and spit juice, soldiers, lumps and boobridge, sabers on the table among the beer mugs, Mexicans in serapes, huge and umbrellas, vile of use. Arms with straw hats and faded overalls, sinners with cold rips, loaning on their rigs, bearded ruffians in greasy buckskins bright with beadwork, chattering through their noses in a language which I recognized to my amazement as Scotch Gaelic. Bright-eyed harpies, watchful in shack doorways, Spanish riders in ponchos and feathered bonnets, their sashes stuffed with flintlock pistols. A party of Indians beneath the trees, faces grotesquely painted, hatchets at their belts, and lances stacked. Silent plainsmen in fur caps and long-fringed skirts, carrying buffalo guns and powder horns. A coach guard with 2 6-shooters at his hips, 2 5-shooters in his waistband, a slung revolving rifle, a broadsword, and a knife in his boot. Oh, and he was gnawing a toothpick, too. An incredibly lean and ancient hunter, white-bearded to the waist, dressed in ragged deerskin and billycock hat, his nail-driver rifle across the crupper of his mule, staring ahead like a faker in a trance as he rode slowly up the street, his slovenly Indian squaw at his stirrup. Through the crowds of loafers and porters and barefoot boys scuffling under the wagons, the swaggering French voyageurs, gaudy and noisy, the drummers and counter-jumpers and sharp-faced Yankees, planters and crooks and rivermen, trappers and miners, and plain honest folk wondering how they'd strayed into this Babel. And those are only the ones I noticed in the first mile or so. But soft, who is this stalwart figure with the dashing whiskers so admirably set off by his wide-awake hat and fringed deerskin shirt? A new patent Colt repeater strapped to his manly rump, his well-turned shanks encased in new boots, which are pinching the bejesus out of him. Can it be other than Arapaho Harry, scourge of the plains? That alert and smouldering eye must oft have hardened at the sound of the shrill war whoop, or narrowed behind the sights as he nailed the rampant grizzly. Now it is soft and genial as he chivvies the dusky whores into the back of the cart, an indulgent smile playing across his noble features. Mark the grace with which he vaults nimbly into the driver's seat beside the bedizened trot in the feathered bonnet. His aunt, doubtless, and with an expert chuck on the reins, sets the team in motion and bogs the whole contraption axle deep in the gumbo. The whores squeak in a... The aunt. His wife, you say? rails and adjusts her finery. But the gallant frontiersman, unperturbed save for a blistering oath which mantles the cheeks of his fair companions in blushes, is equal to the emergency. For two bits, he gets a gang of loafers to haul them out. The Western journey is not without its trials. It's going to be a long trek to California. But at least it looked as though we were going to make it in some style. Once we got the rig out of the stew and rattled through Westport and the great sea of emigrant tents and wagons to Independence, which was a pretty little place then, with a couple of spires and a town hall with a belfry, of which the inhabitants were immensely proud, we were greeted by the celebrated Colonel Owens, a breezy old file with check trousers full of belly and a knowing eye. He was the leading merchant, and had been commissioned to outfit Susie's caravan. He and the boys made us welcome at the store, pressed sherry cobblers on me, bowed and leered gallantly at Susie, and assured us that a trip across the plains was a glorified picnic. "You'll find, ma'am," says the Colonel, ankle cocked and cigar flourish, "that everything's in real prime train. Indeedy, your health, sir." "Yes, ma'am, 6 Pittsburgh wagons, spanking new, 30 yoke of good oxen, a dozen mules, and a real bang-up traveling carriage. The very best Hiram Young can furnish, patent springs, hand-painted, cushioned seats, watertight for fording streams, seats half a dozen comfortable. Fact is," with a broad wink, "it's one of the new mail company coaches, but Hiram procured it as a personal favor. Indeed, you won't find a more elegant conveyance outside Boston. Am I right, boys?" The boys agreed that he was, and added in hushed tones that the mail company intended to charge $250 a head for the 3-week non-stop run to Santa Fe. "And how about that?"
"We're going to take 3 months," says Susie, "and 10 cents a pound for freight is quite dear enough, thank you, to say nothing of $50 a month for guards and drivers, who'll eat like wolves, if I know anything."
"Well now, ma'am, I see you've a proper head for business," chuckles the Colonel, "and a real pretty head it is, too, if I may say. But good men don't come cheap, eh, boys?" The boys swore it was true. Why, a good stockman could make 200 a week without going west of Big Blue.
"I'm not hiring stockmen," says Susie. "I'm paying high for reliable men who can look after themselves and me."
"And you shall have the best, ma'am," cries the Colonel. "Say, I like your style, oh. Your health again, Mr. Comer. Indeedy. 8 outriders, each with a revolving rifle and a brace of patent pistols. Why, that's 100 shots without reloading. A regiment couldn't afford better protection." "A regiment, did I say? Why, 3 of these men rolled with Kearney in the Mexican War. Seasoned veterans, ma'am, every one. Isn't that so, boys?" The boys couldn't fault him. Dogged if they knew how the army would have managed without those 3. I remarked that so much firepower was impressive and seemed to argue necessity. I'd been noting a bill on the store wall advertising, "Ho, hist, attention! Californians, why not take, among other necessaries, your own monuments and tombstones? A great saving can be effected by having their inscriptions cut in New York beforehand." The Colonel looked serious and called for more cobblers. "Indian depredations this past 10 years, sir, have been serious and multiplying," says he solemnly. "Indeedy, red sons of bitches wherever you look. Oh, beg pardon, ma'am, that runaway tongue of mine. However, with such vast convoys of emigrants now moving west, I foresee no cause for apprehension. Safety in numbers, Mr. Comer, eh? Besides, the tribes are unusually peaceful at present. Eh, boys?" The boys couldn't remember such tranquility. It was Sunday afternoon the whole way to the Rockies, with all the Indians retired or gone into farming or catching the cholera. That last was true enough, by the way. Susie inquired about a guide, reminding the Colonel she'd asked for the best, and he smacked his thigh and beamed. "Now, ma'am, you can set your mind to rest there. Yes, indeed, I reckon you can just about." And the boys grinned approval without even being asked.
"Is it Mr. Williams?" says Susie. I was told to ask for him special.
Well, now, ma'am, I'm afraid old Bill doesn't come out of the mountains much these days.
The boys confirmed that indeed old Bill was out west with Fremont.
No, I'm afraid Fitzpatrick and Beckworth aren't available either. But they're no loss, believe me, when you see who I've engaged. Subject to his meeting you and agreeing to take the command, of course.
And he nodded to one of the boys who went out in the stoop and bawled,
Richie!
Command? Says Susie, bridling. Any commanding that's to be done, my husband'll do.
Which gave me a nasty start, I can tell you.
He's in charge of our caravan, and the guide'll take his pay and do what he's told. The idea!
The colonel looked at the boys, and the boys looked at the colonel, and they all looked at me.
Well, now, ma'am, says Owens doubtfully. I'm sure Mr. Comer is a gentleman of great ability, but...
He's an officer of the Royal Navy, snapped Susie, and quite accustomed to command, aren't you, my love?
I agreed, but remarked that leading a caravan must be specialized work, and doubtless there were many better qualified than I, which was stark truth, apart from which I'd no wish to be badgering rough riders and arguing with drunk teamsters, when I could be rolling in a hand-painted, watertight coach.
Seeing my diffidence, she rounded on me, demanding if I was going to take orders from some grubby little carter. I said,
While the colonel called loudly for cobblers and the boys looked tactfully at the ceiling, and just then a burly scarecrow came into the store, or rather he seemed to drift in silently, and the colonel introduced him as Mr. Wotton, our guide. I heard Susie sniff in astonishment. Well, he was grubby, no error, and hadn't shaved in a while, and his clothes looked as though he'd taken them off a dead buckskin man and then slept in them for a year. He seemed diffident, too, fiddling with his hat and looking at the floor. When the colonel told him about my commanding the caravan, he thought for a bit and then said, in a gentle, husky voice,
"Gentleman been wagon captain afore?"
"No," said the colonel, and the boys looked askance and coughed. The clodpole scratched his head and asks,
"Gentleman been an engine country?"
"No," they said, "I hadn't." He stood a full minute, still not looking up, and then says,
"Gentleman got no experience?"
At this one of the boys laughed, and I sent Susie ready to burst, and I was about fed up being ridiculed by these blasted shore bacons. God knows I didn't want to command a caravan, but enough's enough. "I've had some experience, Mr. Wotton," says I. "I was once an army chief of staff, sergeant general to the nigger rabble of Madagascar, but there you are, and have known service in India, Afghanistan, and Borneo. But I've no special desire." At this, Wotton lifted his unkempt head and looked at me, and I stopped dead. He was a ragged nobody, with eyes like clear blue lights, straight and steady. Then he glanced away, and I thought, don't let this one go. It may be a picnic on the plains, but you'll be none the worse with him along. "My dear," says I to Susie, "perhaps you and the colonel will excuse Mr. Wotton and myself." I went out, and presently Wotton drifts on to the stoop, not looking at me. "Mr. Wotton," says I, "my wife wants me to command the caravan, and what she wants she gets. Now, I'm not your old Bill Williams, but I'm not a greenhorn exactly. I don't mind being called wagon captain, but you're the guide, and what you say goes. You can say it to me quietly, and I'll say it to everyone else, and you'll get an extra 100 a month. What do you say?" It was her money, after all. He said nothing, so I went on. "If you're concerned that your friends will think poorly of you for serving under a tenderfoot..." At this he turned the blue eyes on me and kept them there, deuced uncomfortable. Still, he was silent, but presently looked about as though considering, and then says, after a while,
"Got a study, I reckon. Carried liquor with me."
I accepted, and he led the way to where a couple of mules were tethered, watching me sidelong as I mounted. Well, I'd forgotten more about backing a beast than he'd ever know, so I was all right there. We cantered down the street and out through the tents and wagons towards Westport, and presently came to a big lodge with Last Chance
painted in gold leaf on its signboard, which was doing a roaring trade. Richie got a jug, and we rode off towards some trees, and all the time he was deep in thought, occasionally glancing at me but not saying a word. I didn't mind, it was a warm day, I was enjoying the ride, and there was plenty to see. Over by the wood, some hunters were popping their rifles at an invisible target. When we got closer, I saw they were driving the nail, which is shooting from 50 paces or so at a broad-headed nail stuck in a tree, the aim being to drive it full into the wood, which, with a ball the size of a small pea, is fancy shooting anywhere. Richie gave a grunt when he saw them, and we rode near to where a group of them were standing, near the nail tree, whooping and catcalling at every shot. Richie dismounted. "Kindly care to sit a whiles," says he, and indicated a tree stump with all the grace of a Versailles courtier. He even put the jug down beside it. So I sat and waited and took a pull at the jug, which was first-run rum, and no mistake, while Richie went over and talked to the hunters, fellows in moccasins and fringed tunics for the most part, burned brown and bearded all over. It was only when some of them turned to look at me and chortled in their barbarous plugger-plue dialect, which is barely recognizable as English, that I realized the brute was absolutely consulting them. About me, if you please. Well, by God, I wasn't having that, and I was on the point of storming off when the group came over, all a grin, and by George, didn't they stink just? I was on my feet, ready to leave, and then I stopped, thunderstruck. For the first of them, a tall, grizzled mountaineer in a waterproof hat and leggings was wearing an undoubted lifeguard's tunic. Threadbare but well kept. I blinked. Yes, it was Tin Billy gear, no error. "Hurrah, how's how ye?" cries this apparition. "Where the devil did you get that coat?" says I. "You're English," says he, grinning. "Well, I tell you, this yer garment was give me by one of your folks. Scotch fella, sure enough, baronight, which is a kind of lord, don't you know? Name was Stuart. Say, wasn't he the prime coon, though? He could have drubbed that nail there with his eyes shut." He considered me, scratching his chin, and I found myself wishing my buckskin coat wasn't so infernally new. "Richie Hayer says he's uncertain if you'll make a wagon captain." "Is he, by God? Well, you can tell Richie, mister," says he. "You know this?" And he held up a short stick of what looked like twisted leather. "Certainly it's cured beef, biltong. Now what? Don't mind me, horse," says he, and winked like a 10-year-old as he stepped closer. "We're humouring old Richie there. Now then, how long a hobble you putting a pony?" I almost told him to go to the devil, but he winked again, and I said for him he was a hard man to refuse. Besides, what was I to do? If I'd turned my back on that group of bearded, grinning mountebanks, they'd have split their sides laughing. "Well, that depends on the pony," says I, "and the grazing, and how far you've ridden, and where you are, and how much sense you've got. 2 feet, perhaps? 3? He cackled with laughter and slapped his thigh, and the buckskin men haw-hawed and looked at Richie, who was standing head down, listening. My interrogator said, "Here's a catechism, sure enough." And he was so pleased with himself and so plainly intent on making a game of Richie that I decided to enter into the spirit of the thing. "Next question, please," says I, and he clapped his hands. "Now, let's calculate. Here's a good one. Here's a night camp. I'm a guard. What you suppose I'm a-doing?" He looked at a bush about 20 yards away, walked a few paces aside, and looked at it again, then came back to me. "Acting peculiar, horse, you reckon?" "No such thing. You're taking a sight on that bush. You'll take a sight on all the bushes. After dark, if a bush isn't where it should be, you'll fire on it, because it'll be an Indian, won't it? We'd done the same thing in Afghanistan. Any fool of a soldier knows the dodge." "Ha!" shouts he, delighted, and thumped Richie on the back. "There, boy, this child here'll tickle you, see if he don't. Now what?" Richie was watching me in silence, very thoughtful. Presently he nodded slowly, while the buckskin men nudged each other and my questioner beamed his satisfaction. Then Richie tapped my pistol butt, and pulling a scrap of cloth from his pocket, drifted over to the tree and began to snag it on the half-driven nail. My tall companion chuckled and shook his head. Well, I saw what was wanted, and I thought, to blazes with it. I'd taken as much examination from these clowns as I wanted. So I decided to put Master Richie in his place. The tall chap had a knife in his waistband, and without by your leave, I plucked it out. It was a Green Ripper, which is the best knife in the world, and just the article to practice the trick that Ilderim Khan had taught me with infinite patience on the Kabul road almost 10 years before. As Richie adjusted his target, I threw the knife overhand. My eye was well out, for I was nowhere near the mark, but I damn near took his ear off. He looked at the blade quivering in the trunk beside his face, while a tall buffoon cackled with laughter, and the buckskin men doubled up and haw-hawed. If I'd put it through the back of his head, I dare say that would have been a real joke. Richie pulled the knife free, while his pals rolled about, and drifted over to me. He looked at me for a moment with those steady blue eyes, and glanced at the tall chap, and then said, in that gentle husky voice, "I'm Uncle Dick. An extra 100, you said, Captain?" The men who roared and shouted, "Good old Virginny! How's your herd, Dick?" I nodded and said I would see him at sunrise, sharp. Bade them a courteous good day and rode back to Independence without more ado. I know when to play the man of few words myself, you see. But I didn't delude myself that I'd prove my fitness to be a wagon captain or any rot of that sort. All I had shown, through the eccentric good office of our friend in the tin belly coat, was that I wasn't a know-nothing, and Wotton could take service under me without losing face. They were an odd lot, these frontiersmen, simple and shrewd enough, and as easy, and as difficult, to impose upon as children are. But I was glad Wotton would be our guide. Being a true-bred rascal and coward myself, I know a good man when I see one, and he was the best. We started west 3 days later, but I'm not going to take up your time with wordy descriptions of the journey, which you can get from Parkman or Gregg if you want them, or from Volume 2 of my own great work, Dawns and Departures of a Soldier's Life, although it ain't worth the price, in my opinion, and all the good scandal about Disraeli and Lady Cardigan is in the third volume anyway. But what I shall try to do, looking back in a way that Parkman and the others didn't, is to try to tell you what it meant to go west in the earlies. And that was something none of us understood at the time, or the chances are we'd never have gone. You look at a map of America nowadays, and there she is, civilized, give or take the population, from sea to sea. You can board a train in New York City and get off in Frisco without ever stepping outside, let alone get your feet wet. You can even do what I've done, look out from your Pullman on the Atchison, Topeka as you cross Walnut Creek, and see the very ruts your wagon made 50 years before, and pass through great cities that were Bald Head Prairie the first time you went by, and vast wheat fields where you remember the buffalo herds 2 miles from wing to wing. Why, I had coffee on a veranda in a little town in Colorado just last year. Fine place. Church with a steeple, schoolhouse, grain warehouse, and even a motor car at the front gate. First time I saw that place, it consisted of a burning wagon. Its population was a scalped family. Now, you must look at the map of America. See the Mississippi River, and just left of it, Kansas City. West of that, in 49, there was nothing. And it was an unknown nothing, that's the point. You can say now that ahead of the 49ers stretched more than 2,000 miles of empty prairie and forest and mountain and great rivers, but we didn't know that, in so many words. Oh, everyone knew that the Rockies were 1,000 miles off, and the general lie of the country. But take a look at what is now North Texas and Oklahoma. In 49, it was believed that there was a vast range of mountains there, blocking the way west, when in fact, the whole stretch is as flat as your hat. Somewhere around the same region, it was believed, was the Great American Desert, which didn't exist. Oh, there's desert, plenty of it farther west. Nobody knew much about that. I say it was unknown. Certainly the mountain men and hunters had walked over plenty of it. That crazy bastard Fremont went away in a great frenzy and getting thoroughly lost, by all accounts. But when you consider that in 49 it was less than 60 years since some crazy Scotch trapper had crossed North America for the first time, well, you will understand that its geography was not entirely familiar, west of the Miss. Look at the map again, and remember that beyond Westport there was no such thing as a road. There were two trails, to all intents, and they were just wagon tracks. The Santa Fe and the Oregon. You didn't think of roads then. You thought of rivers and passes. Arkansas, Cimarron, Del Norte, Platte, Picket Wire, Colorado, Canadian. Those were the magic river names. Glorieta, Raton, South Pass, those were the passes. There were no settlements worth a damn, even. Santa Fe was a town, sure enough, if you ever got there. And after that you had nothing until San Diego and Frisco and the rest of the cities of the West Coast. But in between, the best you could hope for were a few scattered forts and trading posts. Bent's, Taos, Laramie, Bridger, St. Vrain, and a few more. Hell's bells, I rode across Denver when the damn place wasn't even there. No, it was the unknown then, to us at least. Millions of square miles of emptiness, which would have been hard enough to cross even if it had truly been empty. What with dust storms, drought, floods, fire, mountains, snow drifts that could be 70 feet deep, cyclones, and the like. But it wasn't empty, of course. There were several thousand well-established inhabitants, named Cheyenne, Kiowa, Ute, Sioux, Navajo, Pawnee, Shoshone, Blackfeet, Comanche, and Apache. Especially Apache, but even they were hardly even names to us, and the belief, I give you only my own impression, in the East was that their nuisance had been greatly exaggerated. So you see, we started in fairly blissful ignorance. But before we do, take one last look at the map before Professor Flashy endeth the lesson. See the Arkansas River and the Rockies? Until the 1840s, they'd been virtually the western and southwestern limits of the USA. Then came the war with Mexico, and the Yankees won the whole shooting match that they own today. So when we jumped off for California, we were heading into country three-quarters of which had been Mexican until a few months before, and still was in everything but name. Some of it was called Indian Territory, and that was no lie either. That was what lay ahead of us, gullible asses that we were. And if you think it was tough, you should have seen the Coma caravan loading up in the meadow at Westport. I've squared away and ridden herd upon most kind of convoys in my time, but shipping a brothel was a new one on me. Visiting 'em in situ, you don't realize how elaborately furnished they are. When I saw the pile of gear that had come ashore off the steamboat, I didn't credit it. A stevedore would have taken to drink. For one thing, the sluts all had their dressing tables and mirrors and wardrobes, stuffed with silks and satins and gowns and underclothes and hats and stockings and shoes and garters and ribbons and jewelry and cosmetics and wigs and masks and gloves and God knows what beside. There were several enormous chests which Susie called equipment, and which, if they'd burst open in public, would have led to the intervention of the police. Gauzy trousers and silk whips were the least of it. There was even a red plush swing and an electrical mattress. So help me. "Susie," says I ain't old enough to take responsibility for this cargo. Dear God, Caligula wouldn't know what to do with it. You've had some damned odd customers in Orleans, haven't you?
We won't be able to buy it in Sacramento, says she.
You couldn't buy it in Babylon, says I. See here, two of the wagons must be given over to food. We need enough flour, tea, dried fruit, beans, corn, sugar, and all the rest of it to feed 40 folk for 3 months. At this rate, we'll finish up eating lace drawers and frilly corsets. She told me not to be indelicate, and it will all have to go aboard. She wasn't running an establishment that wasn't altogether tip-top. So, in went the fancy bed linen and tasseled curtains and carpets and chairs and chaise longues and hip baths, and a piano with candlesticks, and a case of music, oh yes, and 4 chandeliers and crystal lampshades and incense and bath salts and perfumes and snuff and cigars and 40 cases of burgundy. I told the demented bitch it wouldn't travel. And oil paintings of an indecent nature in gilt frames, and sealed boxes of cheese, and rahat lakum, and soap and pomade, and to crown all, a box of opium, with Cleone's parrot in its cage to top everything off. In the end, we had to hire 2 extra wagons.
It's worth it, says Susie to my protests. It's all investment, darling, and we'll reap the benefit, you'll see.
Provided the goldfields are manned entirely by decadent frog poets, we'll make a bloody fortune, says I. Thank God we shan't have to go through customs. The whores were another anxiety, for while Susie had them thoroughly chastened and kept them dressed like charity girls, they wouldn't have fooled an infant. They were all coloured and stunners, and they didn't walk or even sit like nuns, exactly. You just had to look at the stately black Aphrodite, regarding herself in a hand mirror, while the pert, creamy Claudia dressed her hair, or Josephine perched languidly on a box, contemplating her shapely little feet with satisfaction, or Medea and Cleone sauntering among the wild flowers with their parasols, or the voluptuous Eugenie reclining in a wagon, sultry-eyed and toying with her fan. No, you could tell they weren't choir girls. I took one look at the score of drivers and guards that Owens had hired for us, and concluded that we'd have been a sight safer carrying gold bullion. They were decent men enough, as hard cases go. Half of them bearded buckskin ears, a few in faded army blues, and all well mounted and armed to the teeth with revolving pistols and rifles. Their top spark was a rangy, well-knit Ulsterman with sandy whiskers and a soft-spoken honeycomb voice. His name, he informed me, was Grattan Nugent Hare.
With the hyphen, sir, which is a bit of a pose, don't you know, but I'm attached to it.
There was a dark patch on his sleeve where chevrons had been. When he dismounted, it was like a seal sliding off a rock. Gentleman ranker, thinks I. Bog Irish gentry. Village school, seen inside Dublin Castle, no doubt, but no rhino for a commission. A very easy, likely lad with a lazy smile and a long nose.
You're with Kearney, says I, and before that, 10th Hussars, says he,
and I couldn't help exclaiming, Cheney 10th, at which he opened his sleepy eyes a little wider. I could have bitten my fool tongue out.
Why, so it was.
And you're a neighbour, gentleman, they tell me, Mr. Comer. Your pardon, captain, I should say.
He nodded amiably.
Well, well, do you know I'd have put you down for cavalry yourself by the set of the whiskers. I'd have been adrift there, though, right enough.
It gave me a turn. This was a sharp one. The last thing I wanted just then was an old British Army acquaintance. But I'd never known the 10th except by name, which was a relief.
And how far west did you go with Kearney? I asked.
That was after Santa Fe, do you see, so it's not new country to me altogether. But I apprehend you're all the way for California with the ladies.
And he glanced past me to where Susie was chivying the tarts out of sight into the wagons. He grinned.
My stars, but they're as bonny as fluffy little door rabbits on the green, so they are.
And that's the way they'll stay, Mr. Nugent Hare.
Call me Grattan,
says he, and grinned as he patted his pony's muzzle.
I'm up the road ahead of you, Mr. Comer. You were about to say, I think, that after a few weeks those boys and men might feel the fever, and those charming little babes, if you'll forgive the term, would prove a temptation. Not at all, at all. They'll be as safe as if they were in St. Ursula's.
He tilted his hat back, not smiling now.
Believe me, if I didn't know how to manage rascals like these, I wouldn't be here, would I now?
He was a cocksure one, this, but probably, I reflected, not without cause. The army had left its stamp on him, all right. I reminded him that military discipline was one thing, and these were civilians out in the plains. He laughed pleasantly.
Military discipline be damned, says he. It's simple as shelling peas. If one of 'em so much as tips his tire to you young ladies, I'll blow the bastard's head off. And now, sir, the order of march. What would you say to a point rider, a rear guard, two to a flank, and myself riding loose, if that would be agreeable? And you'll be riding herd yourself, quite so.
If his nose hadn't been quite so long and his smile so open, it would have been a pleasure to do business with him. Still, he knew his work, and he was being well paid. Captain or no captain, it struck me I might spend most of the trip lounging in the carriage after all. However, when the great moment of starting came, I was in the saddle, in full buckskin fig, for one has to show willing. With Wotton silent alongside, I led the way down the meadow and into the trees, and after us trundled the carriage, with Susie fanning herself like Cleopatra, and her knicker maid and cook perched behind, and then the 8 big schooners, flanked by Nugent Hare's riders. Their canvas covers were rolled up like furled sails in the spring sunshine, with the tarts sitting primly 2 by 2. In the rear came the mules, with a couple of Mexican sabaneros, the 300-pound loads piled incredibly high and swaying perilously. It was a well-rutted trail, and the schooners rolled now and then, which caused some flutter and squeak among the girls. But I noticed that the guards, who might have taken the opportunity to render gallant assistance, barely glanced in their direction. Perhaps Grattan was as strong a straw boss as he made out, after all. Once through the timber, we came out on the prairie itself, all bright with the early summer flowers, and I galloped ahead to a little hillock for a look-see. That's a moment I remember still. Behind lay the woods with the smoke haze rising from Westport. Left and right, and as far ahead as the eye could see, was limitless rolling plain, dotted with clumps of oaks and bushes, the grass blowing gently in the breeze, and fleecy clouds against a blue sky that seemed to stretch forever. Below, the wagons crawled along the trail, its furrows running clear and straight to the far horizon, where you could just see the last wagon of the caravan ahead. And I absolutely laughed aloud. Why, I can't tell, except that in that moment I felt free and contented and full of hope, with my spirits bubbling as high as they've ever done in my life. Others I know have felt the same thing about starting on the trail west. There's an exhilaration, a sense of leaving the old, ugly world behind, and that there's something splendid waiting for you to go and find it, far out yonder. I wonder if I'd feel it now, or if it happens only when you're young and have no thought for the ill things that may lie along the way. For it's an illusion, you know, the start of the trail. Those first 10 days lull you to sleep as you roll gently down over that changeless plain, through the well-used camp places to Council Grove, which is the great assembly point where little caravans like ours form themselves into regular wagon trains for the long haul to the mountains. There. I'm writing in the present tense as though we're all in front of me again. Well, it ain't, thank God. But it soon becomes dull. The only notable thing happened about the 3rd day, when we came to a little stream and copse, where there was a fairish assembly of wagons, and the trail divided. Our fork continuing southwest, while the northern trail branched up towards the Kansas River, and then to the North Platte, and eventually to Oregon. As we were breaking camp with several other California-bound parties, the Oregon folk were already setting out, and there was great badinage and cheering and singing as they got underway.
They were a serious lot, those Oregoners, being mostly farm folk intent on honest work. Not like us California scamps off to the gold fields. We were a raffish crew. But they were sober men and grim women, with never a tin pan or a rope out of place. Everything lashed down hard and the kids peeping solemnly over the tailboards. They had an American flag on their lead wagon, and their captain was a bearded nemesis in a tailcoat, his harsh voice echoing down the mule lines. One train, are you set? Two train, are you set? And every arriero sang out in turn, all set, all set, which was the signal to go, for you don't loaf about with a laden mule, and you don't stop for a noon halt either, or the brute will never start off again. So now it was all set, and the whips cracked, and the skinners yelled, and the wheels groaned, and the great train rolled away, and the mules plodded forward with their bells jingling. And all the California people yelled and waved their hats and hurrahed and fluttered their handkerchiefs and cried, good luck, Oregon a bust, take care and God bless you, and the like. And the Oregon folk waved back and began to sing a song that I've forgotten now, except that it went to the tune of Greensleeves and was all about how the Lord would have a land of milk and honey flowing for his children over there. And the women from the California wagons began to cry, and some of them hurried after the Oregoners with their aprons kilted up, offering them last gifts of pies and cakes. And the children went scampering along after the wagons, whooping and cheering, except for the little ones who stood with their fingers in their mouths, staring at an old minister who sat astride a mule beside the trail and blessed the Oregon people with his Bible held above his head. And the caravan wound over the ridge and out of sight, and there was a sudden stillness in the campsite under the trees. And then someone said, we'll better get started ourselves. Come on, mother. And they cheered up. So they were a jolly, carefree lot that went to California that year, with their wagons piled any old how with all sorts of rubbish that they thought might prove useful at the diggings, like patent tents and Macintosh boats. Gold seekers, take heed. Our rubber boats and shelters are unsurpassed. You cannot face the chill of the gold rivers without a rubber suit.